Buddy? It's time for us to get started. We are in Joshua chapter 4. We're going to begin in verse 15. All right, so we kind of hit the middle point of this whole part of the story. So we've had the memorial stones talked about. You know, we've had the crossing talked about. We've seen the crossing itself take place. And now we're going to kind of get things from the perspective of the other bank. Right? And remember, we've talked about how this story kind of unfolds itself pretty slowly. We've already read in Joshua chapter 4, verse 1, that all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan. And then, of course, we read later in the chapter about them crossing the Jordan. And now we're going to read about them coming out of the Jordan again. But again, it's going to be from the perspective of the other bank. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Command the priests bearing the Ark of the Testimony to come up out of the Jordan." So Joshua commanded the priests, "Come up out of the Jordan." And when the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up on dry ground, the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. The people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they encamped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, "When your children ask their fathers in times to come, 'What do these stones mean?' then you shall let your children know, 'Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground.' For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over. So that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever." All right. So, again, we're getting another perspective on the crossing. We have seen, you know, the people had already passed over. In fact, we had even already read in verse 11 about when all the people had finished passing over, the Ark of the Lord and the priests passed over before the people. Right? So we've read these details before. But that was from the perspective from down in the riverbed, as it were. And here we're given the perspective from Joshua's place in the promised land. All right, command them to come up out of the river. This is the first time in the book of Joshua that we have seen the Ark referred to as the Ark of the Testimony. Now, we've seen this name before for the Ark in the Law of Moses. The word testimony almost always refers to God's Word, usually specifically dealing with His covenant. His promises, his arrangement with his people. So calling the Ark of the Testimony here reminds us of, first off, Israel's special place with God, God's fulfillment of his word. These are major themes of what's going on in the book of Joshua. Israel belongs to God. Israel's being obedient to God. They're keeping their part of the covenant, the testimony. We see God keeping his part of that testimony. So just as he promises at the beginning of the story, so it happens. And we see that fulfilled. And so now we get the Ark referred to as the Ark of the Testimony. It also calls to mind what is inside the Ark. Right? The testimony itself, these tablets of stone. The use of this name, again, here brings to mind the context in which this happens. The commands and the promises of the Lord, both of which are fulfilled in this passage. So it centers the whole story around God's word, the people's keeping of it, and his keeping of his promises. Let's see. The rest of what the story tells us about the priest coming up out of the river is basically a mirror image of what we read at the beginning of the story about their going down into the river. And I think that's done deliberately, that we get this mirroring. There's this really tight symmetry in the story, which again, we kind of demonstrated by just the way that the story is laid out. But when the priests go down into the river, as soon as their feet touch the water, then the water is, the river is stopped, it's heaped up, far away to the north near Adam. And then the moment that they come out of the water, right, when the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up on the dry ground. So again, notice the focus on their feet. Just the moment their feet leave that river, the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. All right, so just instantaneous. Just as instantly as the miracle was accomplished, the miracle is released, as it were. So we saw the Jordan overflowing its banks. It's flooding beforehand, and now it's gone back to flooding. The next part of the story, actually, I feel like we can stop there for just a second. Any questions or comments up through, say, like verse 18? Okay. So what happens after that is the setting up of the memorial stones. And again, we have seen this unfolding over the course of the book. The setting aside of the 12 men, and then the instructions for the 12 men to take 12 stones. Then we see that Joshua has picked out the stones and set them up in the river for them to take out. And now we're finally getting the placement of the stones. And we learn that it takes place at Gilgal. Now, we don't know yet why that place is called Gilgal. All right, this is going to be another part of the unfolding nature of this story. But they are at a place called Gilgal on the east border of Jericho, and they set up these memorial stones. The story points out when this happens. The people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month. And that's where that is when they encamped at Gilgal and set up these stones. The book, up to this point, has not been too awfully detailed as to recording the dates and the times of things. So here, when it points it out to us, right, that's our signal that there's something significant going on here. Well, the significance we find if we go back to Exodus chapter 12, verse 3. Actually, let's start in chapter 12, verse 1. Exodus 12, 1. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their fathers' houses, a lamb for a household." All right, and of course, we know from the context what's going to happen to that lamb, what that lamb is for. On the 10th day of the first month, they are to select the lamb for the Passover sacrifice. And we are told in Joshua that is the day on which they come out of the river. Now, there's some significance to this, because you've got now two memorials going on at once. Right, as they are setting up these memorial stones, they are also preparing the Passover memorial. Right, the Passover is not going to happen yet, right, not for another few days, but it's at this point that they consecrate the Passover lamb. And at that same time, they are setting up this stone memorial. So the institution of this stone memorial is an explicit reference back to the Passover memorial. Not just because of the day on which it happens, but also the language that's used in describing the stone memorial. All right, go to Joshua 4:21. And he said to the people of Israel, "When your children ask their fathers in times to come, 'What do these stones mean?' then you shall let your children know Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever." All right, so first off, we get an explicit reference back to the Red Sea crossing. Right, that's just laid out plainly for us. But we also have this framed in exactly the same language that the Passover meal is framed. Right, when your children ask their fathers in times to come, what does this mean? This is something that we've read before. All right, we won't go back and look now, just for the sake of time, but if you go back to Exodus 12, you find Moses framing the Passover meal in exactly those same terms in verse 26. When your children ask you in times to come, what is the meaning of this meal? This is what you're supposed to tell them. All right, so we've got this double memorial going on. And there's a double purpose to this stone memorial. First off, that all may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty. So this is a memorial that is outward-looking, meaning it is it testifies, or it bears witness to people outside of Israel as to what God has done for Israel. It also has the purpose that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So it is also an inward-facing memorial, meaning that it makes Israel remember what God has done for them. So, now, I'm going to talk about this a little bit more later, but we can probably already just go ahead and make the connection here. What should that remind us of? A memorial that both reminds us of something that has happened, but is also outward-facing and is itself a proclamation to the world of something that's happened. I mean, what memorial do we have? Oh, you're thinking of two of them. All right, so what are you thinking of, Wayne? Baptism and the Lord's Supper. Right. Lord's Supper especially, like we have it laid out just in plain language for us. You know, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes again. All right, the Lord's Supper as a memorial is essentially it's like a sermon in and of itself. It is a proclamation of the gospel whenever we partake in the Lord's Supper. It's not just meant for us. It is also, what I mean is, you know, it's meant for us to partake, but the significance of it is not just meant for us. Right? The memorial aspect of it is not just meant for us. It is also meant for any outsider who sees it and is aware of it. It is a proclamation to them. All right, so in that way, this setting up of the memorial stones is it's a type, right? It's a foreshadowing of the memorial that is to come in the Lord's Supper. Wayne? Yes.
Which brings up this, I asked you before, is the cloud still there? Because I went back and I did some thinking. According to concordances and Webster's Dictionary and a few other documents, it turns out that it's about a mile. Which comes out to 10
separation between the people and the ark? Or, okay. Wow.
Which brings up the question that if that thing goes over here, well, they would have sighted it, but they don't know where it went.
Uh-huh.
If the plow still over there, they know exactly where it went.
Uh-huh.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then crossing the Jordan, just like at the Red Sea, it's a kind of baptism in that the plow on the top in the water and then they're going under it.
Yeah.
It brings to mind the purification. Mm-hmm. You know, we're baptized into the water.
Yeah.
It
does bring to mind what Paul said, and Paul had the Red Sea crossing in mind when he wrote this, but in 1 Corinthians 10, talking about how all of our fathers, passed through the sea and through the cloud, they were baptized in that. The text doesn't tell us explicitly one way or the other, again, whether the pillar is there or not, but there is a connection to be made that I do plan on making. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, no, that's the connection is there, between the Jordan crossing and baptism.
This brings up another connection, and I don't know if you want to go over this or not.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking, okay, 12 stones that they carried on the shoulder.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking we're not thinking right about that.
Okay.
And the reason why is because, okay, if they carried each one carried one stone.
Uh-huh. Depends on the guy.
Probably these guys were.
Uh-huh.
They were probably the strongest, probably the strongest.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, one guy picked out from the tribe. So, but go ahead.
Still, if, say for instance, they put one stone on all the shoulders at once.
Uh-huh. That's not the way the text reads, though.
I know it's not the way the text reads. I'm just saying, 12 stones.
Yeah.
It would last a long time.
Uh-huh.
Down with,
right.
With
yeah.
Time.
And that's...
Something smaller would not be lasting.
Yeah. So that's the point of having these river stones, is that they're kind of, in a way, they're time-tested, right? That they are still large stones, even though they have been sitting in a riverbed for God knows how long.
Is
right.
This
so they're not going to wear down.
This set up, 12 stones.
Uh-huh.
And again, I go back to the other assumption I made before.
Uh-huh.
Making connections that it didn't die.
Yeah.
If you get 12 very large stones, stacked up in a certain configuration.
Uh-huh.
And this is a part of the Passover. There's a connection with the Passover.
Mm-hmm.
That you think that possibly they held the Passover.
Oh, so I want to say elsewhere. No, it might be in the Septuagint. Where was it? There is some place, not in the Masoretic text here, that talks about setting up those stones as an altar. But it is something that, for some reason, has stuck around with people for a long time. We've got no evidence, as far as I remember, that these are made into an altar. But I seem to remember them setting up altars. We're going to get into the Passover in the very next chapter. So let's hold on to that thought until we get to that text. At the very least, they would have been together because the memorial's at Gilgal, and they're going to keep the first Passover, well, their first Passover at Gilgal. So let's continue on. Chapter 5, verse 1. And we get the next detail in the narrative. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. All right, so God made this promise towards the beginning of the narrative that Canaan is going to be swept away before Israel. So Israel is to have this confidence in themselves. We've not talked about this for a while, but one of the big motifs of the book from the very first chapter is what God told Joshua, be strong and courageous. Right, that's the attitude that is supposed to characterize Israel going into this conquest. We have that contrasted over against what happens to the Canaanites and the Amorites and the other five nations that are living in the Promised Land. They live in terror at what is going on. And it all centers on God. Right? God is the one that's giving Israel their confidence. God is the one who's striking fear into the Canaanites. And at this point in the story, Israel has already won the war before it's even started. Right? And by the way, this description of the Canaanite kings mirrors what Rahab said. Right? Just to put another point in Rahab's column. And I think we might see this a few more times. You notice there have been a lot of things that have happened in the story that have happened exactly the way that Rahab said. Not that she's any kind of prophetess or anything, but yeah, what I mean is that her conversion is sincere, right? Like she knows what's what. She's looking at things from the right perspective, as it were. And so we get this detail about the hearts of these kings melting. There's no longer any spirit in them, and those are the very words that Rahab used of the people of Canaan. Go ahead.
Connecting dots again.
Okay.
Over in verse 13 of chapter 4, it says, about 40,000 ready for war, and have to go before the Lord for battle through the plains of Jericho.
Yeah.
So, there's these 40,000 soldiers that are spreading out across the plains of Jericho.
Right.
And
the people in Jericho can see it.
They see that, they say, they've come across the river, they're here, they're knocking on our door.
Yeah, they're at our door. Yep, exactly. Exactly. And this rumor spreads, fast across Canaan. Okay, so the last thing that we are going to look at is, we're gonna start into a discussion that I doubt we'll be able to finish today. Let's go ahead and get all of the text under our belt. Let's start in verse 2, and we're going to read through. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeah Haraloth. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Though all the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the people of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished because they did not obey the voice of the Lord. The Lord swore to them that he would not let them see the land that the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give to us, a land flowing with milk and honey. So it was their children, whom he raised up in their place, that Joshua circumcised. For they were uncircumcised, because they had not been circumcised on the way. When the circumcising of the whole nation was finished, they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. And so the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. While the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. And the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land. And there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us? Are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, What does my Lord say to his servant? And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. All right, so the crossing into Canaan ends the same way that it began. All right, so we began this all the way back in chapter 3. At the beginning of chapter 3, you have this general instruction. Israel is to consecrate themselves for the crossing and for the coming war. We talked about what that would probably entail, as it did at Sinai whenever God told Israel to consecrate themselves there. They were to ceremonially wash their clothes, and they were to abstain from sexual activity. So here the instruction is general, consecrate yourselves. Now here at the end, we have some specific things going on to consecrate Israel and to consecrate Joshua. We've got three things going on. First off, a specific instruction from the Lord. Joshua is to circumcise the nation of Israel. Then we have them keeping the Passover, which is itself a period of consecration. And then finally, Joshua has this encounter with the commander of the army of the Lord. And it also uses the language of consecration. Right? Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you're standing is holy. And so we've got this whole big section of the text focused on Israel's holiness. They're being set apart for the Lord as they prepare to go into battle to conquer the promised land. So we've probably only got enough time today to talk about the circumcision. So, sorry we got to end on that note, but that's where we're at. So the Lord commands Joshua, make flint knives, circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. Meaning that there is a... Not that these guys had been circumcised once and they were going to be circumcised a second time, but that the nation was going to be circumcised a second time. Which the text goes on to explain, that they had not been circumcised up to that point. And we get a place name for this. Your Bible might tell you, well, it might just translate it for you, depending on your translation. Or if you've got a translation that does not translate the place name, there might be a footnote. Or you might be lucky, and it just doesn't translate it and doesn't tell you what it means. Because you don't really want to know what it means. But I'm going to tell you. Gibeat Ha'aralot, the hill of foreskins. I'll just leave that at that. What we want to focus on here is that the text continues to play off of this Hebrew word tamam, which means to finish. We've seen it throughout the text, where the people of Israel go into the Jordan and they finish crossing the Jordan. And the priests finish what they're doing. All right, we see this word tamam all over the place, and it kind of culminates in what happens here. We learn, as the text explains to us, why this mass circumcision has to happen. It's explained to us that the Egyptian generation, the generation that was circumcised, was finished in the wilderness. Our ESV translates it perished. Let's see. Forget what verse in particular uses the word perish. Verse 6. The people of Israel, the sons of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished. That translates the Hebrew word tamam, which means to finish. Right? They were finished in the wilderness. But then we read later in the text that the circumcision of that second generation, the wilderness generation, was finished, tamam, showing their obedience. So we've got this play going on, where you've got the unfaithful generation that is finished in the wilderness. You have a faithful, obedient generation that is finished in a different sense here in the Promised Land. The text also explains to us why the wilderness generation, or well, I'll just say it explains that the wilderness generation is uncircumcised. It doesn't really explain why they were uncircumcised. The text does not explain what prevented the Egyptian generation, the generation of the Exodus, from circumcising their sons. There's not any kind of reason given. And most of the reasons that I've heard for it don't really square with the text. Right? Maybe one of the most common reasons is that, well, while they're wandering in the wilderness, they have to be in a state of readiness for war all the time. And so you wouldn't circumcise them in the wilderness. That's kind of true, except where are they at right now as they are being circumcised? Yeah, they're in Canaan. They are right outside of Jericho. Right? They are immediately after this. They're going to go up to Jericho, which is not all that far away from where they're encamped, and they're going to besiege the city. Right, we'll see how that plays out. But they are right there, and they've got the river at their backs, and that river is flooding its banks. Right, God has put them in a really vulnerable position, and then he tells them, all right, now's the time to get circumcised, when they are just wide open to attack. Right, so the explanation for why they weren't circumcised in the wilderness can't be, well, it would have made them vulnerable. Well, no, because they're vulnerable here, and God tells them to do it here. If it was a matter of vulnerability, I mean, again, he could have circumcised them in the wilderness. Probably the best explanation is that we're supposed to see this as another mark of the Exodus generation's disobedience, their faithlessness. We're reminded of that really bizarre night attack that happened either against Moses or against his son Gershom. Do you remember this story back in Exodus chapter 4? The bridegroom of blood story? Really, really short text. In fact, we'll go ahead and finish with this. Go back to Exodus chapter 4. This is only a couple of verses long. If you've forgotten about the story, I'm dead certain you'll remember it whenever we start reading the text. So remember, Moses is going back to Egypt at the time with his wife and kids. I think at this point, maybe just kid. But Exodus 4:24, at a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. All right, now, we're not told who he is, by the way. Doesn't specify Moses, doesn't specify Gershom, his son. Yes, the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me. So he let him alone. It was then that she said, a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. Okay. Bizarre event, but what brings this to mind is the use of a flint knife, a stone knife, and also the potential for disaster among Israel when they are not circumcised. Right, this is something that God told Abraham back in Genesis 17. Any of your sons who is uncircumcised will be cut off from his people. And that was what was going on in Exodus chapter 4. The Gershom was uncircumcised and was at risk of being cut off, killed. I think, of the opinion that it's probably Gershom who's under attack there. But you have that in mind and you read a text like this, where you have this whole generation of men in the wilderness who grew up uncircumcised. And you recognize it is only by the extreme grace of the Lord that Israel is still alive. Because this is a terrible mark of disobedience. against the Exodus generation. They did not circumcise their sons. Did I see a hand? Yeah, it's usually the patriarch's job to make sure that this is done. Right? And that's why the situation with Gershom is so extraordinary, that Zipporah has to take it into her own hands to make sure that this is done. And so there is this accusatory note against Moses that he has not been faithful in keeping up the covenant. Which of course is right at the beginning of the story, you know, the Moses story, where we see that Moses is kind of late and disobedient. So, good observation. And that is where we need to stop today, because we have gone over time just a smidge. So, next week we will pick up with, we got a couple more things. We'll talk about the significance of the name Gilgal. We'll talk about the Passover, and we will talk about another somewhat bizarre event. This encounter with the commander of the Lord's army. I'll just finish by saying I absolutely love his answer. Joshua says, "Are you for us or are you for our adversaries?" The angel says, "No." So, absolutely wonderful. We'll see you next week as we study this together. Thank you so much for your kind consideration, questions, and comments this morning.